Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Well, good evening. On behalf of the Tattered Cover Bookstore, it's my pleasure to welcome you and to thank you for your support. Wayne Pacelli is President and Chief Executive Officer of the Humane Society of the United States. He took office in 2004 after serving nearly 10 years as the organization's chief lobbyist and spokesperson. Wayne has become America's foremost voice for those who cannot speak in their own defense and has helped to bring animal protection to the mainstream. He has led more than 25 statewide ballot initiatives, including measures to outlaw cockfighting, factory farming abuses, and a range of other inhumane practices. His inspiring and New York Times best-selling new book, The Bond, Our Kinship with Animals, Our Call to Defend Them, points the way to a new humane economy, one not built on extraction, suffering, and killing, but on the celebration, stewardship, and care of animals. We are delighted that Wayne Pacelli is with us this evening at the Tattered Cover. Would you please join me in making him feel welcome?
Thank you very much. Thank you. Great to see all of you. Thank you so much for coming. Charles, thank you. This has been a real exciting moment for me to come to the Tattered Cover. I've been heard about the bookstore for many, many years and excited to be here in Colorado. And thank you all very, very much for caring about these issues and being here tonight. I want to tell you a little bit about the book, and I want to then take some questions tonight once we're done with my remarks. I have been at this for quite a while. I have been fighting for animals for my entire adult life, and I'm sure, like so many of you, yes. I had this passion for animals, though, ever since I was a little kid. And it was something that was built into me. It was just part of my makeup. It was part of my framework. It was the way that I saw the world. And I'm sure for so many of you, that was your first experience, that animals were just such a passionate concern. You loved them. You wanted to be good to them. How many of you had it right from the get-go? You know, I thought in some ways as I was getting older, into my adolescence and into my adulthood, I thought that I felt this issue more passionately than others did. And I may have felt it more passionately than many people, but I think so many of us have this instinct to do right by the creatures. And it's built into us. It's not something that's invented. It's not something that has to be taught to us. And really the reason I called this book The Bond is I think that we do have this instinctive connection to other creatures. You know, E.O. Wilson, a Harvard biologist, calls it biophilia. He says that we're drawn to other life forms like a moth is drawn to a flame. And if you look at our social behavior in our society, 2/3 of American households have pets. There are 171 million dogs and cats in our homes. There are 70 million of us who are wildlife watchers, so we take to the forests and the fields. We even take on the coast to whale watching boats to watch these creatures in their natural habitats and to enjoy them and to see their majesty. We have Animal Planet on television. We have a surge in publishing about animals. I mean, those of you who might think, well, this is, you know, I'm feeling this more passionately, you are among so many people in the world who are drawn to animals. You know, we're a social being. We need to have interaction with others in order to feel whole and complete. The worst thing you can do to a prisoner is put a prisoner in solitary confinement. A person goes mad in solitary confinement. We need that interaction. Animals fulfill part of that social need that we have to be around others. And you know, there's more and more evidence that there's even some biochemistry to the bond with animals. There's a hormone that all mammals have, including humans, called oxytocin. And this is a social bonding hormone. It's the reason that its presence in us allows us to recognize faces, to be warm when we're around others, to exude this sort of outward excitement when you see other beings. And oxytocin plays a very important role in women's reproduction. It induces lactation and a number of other purposes in reproduction. And it also bonds the mother to the child and the child to the mother. And it's a reason that a mother can stare at her child for 12 hours a day. And, you know, it just stands to reason that this connection that we have with other creatures has some biological basis. Just like other behaviors that we engage in. If someone breaks into our home in the middle of the night, we don't just have this intellectual thought, oh, I should be scared. We have a physical reaction that is induced by hormones in our bodies. Sexual attraction is also an induced behavior. It also makes sense, I think, with more and more evidence showing that we have this reaction around other animals. And you know, there have been more and more reports and studies done with veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan, young men and women who have post-traumatic stress disorder, who can't go out of their homes, they're on medications, they can't sleep at night. When they get a dog, whether it's a companion or a therapy dog, they get off their medication, they feel better, they can get out of the household. It's a reason why, you know, dogs go to nursing homes, they go to senior centers. Animals have this incredible rehabilitative effect on us. And you know, one of the things I argue in the book is that it's not something that's new. Throughout all of human history, we've been connected to animals. Before we developed agriculture, when we were hunting and gathering societies, these communities, these tribal communities, the individuals knew all about animal behavior. They knew all the different plants. They were connected to the natural world. And yes, they hunted animals and they killed animals, but there was a ritual of atonement. There were apologies made to the animals. And again, it was a different day and a different way that this bond was manifest, but it was real enough. And even if we look at today's tribal communities in Brazil, in Southeast Asia, like New Guinea, we see not only this connection with animals, but there's actually pet keeping in many of these tribal societies. They're wild animals often that they keep as pets. We are drawn to other creatures, and it gives us, I think, a head start in making the right decisions about how we're going to treat animals. But it's very easy for this to spin off the track and to go wrong somewhere. And one of the things I grapple with in my book is this incredible set of contradictions that exists in our society. That we have so much love and appreciation for animals, yet we also have so much cruelty and indifference. You know, I mentioned all of the pet keeping and the wildlife watching. We also have 10,000 animal protection organizations in the United States. HSUS is just the largest of them. But there are groups to defend almost every kind of animal you can think of. There are groups to defend bears or snow leopards or mountain lions. There are groups to defend whales and dolphins and so many different creatures of the sea. There are groups to defend feral cats. There are Labrador Rescue and St. Bernard Rescue. There are guinea pig defense groups. There are rabbit defense groups. You know, we support a rabbit sanctuary in South Carolina to take in injured and homeless rabbits. And our motto for this sanctuary is we provide hope for the hopless. And, you know, you can think about just every kind of animal. There is a group or a person who's out there to defend them. But the flip side of that is, why do we need 10,000 organizations that exist to defend animals? What has gone wrong in our society to create this need for charity and philanthropy and volunteerism and advocacy? And this is the really tough question for us. And you know, a lot of social movements are born out of crisis. And our movement to care for animals was born out of crisis in the 19th century. It was a moment when we had new technologies and an attitude of domination. And in the 19th century, if you look at what we did to wildlife, look at what we did to the American buffalo, the bison. There were 40 to 60 million bison roaming the Great Plains of the North American continent. We developed the repeating firearm, the Transcontinental Railroad. In the span of just three decades, we reduced their numbers from 40 to 60 million to just 500 animals. 500 animals. And they were saved only because they were in Yellowstone National Park. She doesn't agree with the bond, obviously. Or she's upset about what happened to all of the animals in the 19th century. You know, so in the span of three decades, to think of reducing numbers to that degree, and then we completely eliminated the passenger pigeon. And then when you think about what was going on in the newly emerging cities in North America, we were using horses to transport people and goods, and people were overworking horses and driving them too far and whipping them. And there were some people just after the Civil War who said, hey, we've got to get some control. We've got to place some limits on what's going on. And the first organization, the ASPCA, was formed in 1866, and a number of other groups were formed in the late 1860s, 1870s, including the Denver Dumb Friends League in this period as well. And it was a recognition that we've got to have some limits, we've got to have some responsibility in this relationship. And I think, you know, since that time, we've been grappling with this power that we have, this immense power that we hold over the creatures. Our technology and our strength over animals continues to progress. And how do we handle this? And if you look at what's going on today in our society, I mean, things have gotten so much better in so many ways, but they've also gotten worse. I mean, we have so many innovations in cruelty, not just things like canned hunting or captive hunting or internet hunting or animal crush videos, but even within the last 50 years, we've seen the emergence of factory farming, the industrial production of animals. I mean, we've had a mass migration of animals from outdoor settings to indoor settings, to warehouses where many of the animals are confined in cages and crates barely larger than their bodies. So veal calves are in a 22-inch wide crate, immobilized. Breeding sows are in a 2-foot by 7-foot cage where they're in this cage for 3 years, and they essentially can't move but a step forward and a step back. Laying hens are captured in battery cages, small wire cages, where 6 to 8 birds are kept in this small area. Each bird has 67 square inches of space, less than an 8.5 by 11 piece of paper, as the living space for the animal for 1.5 or 2 years. You know, I think of this, and I think of it as an example of human innovation detached from conscience. You know, it's a remarkable achievement to be able to raise 10 billion animals in our society and to slaughter them, and to have these factory farms where there may be millions of chickens or tens of thousands of pigs on a single operation. But does it really reflect our values? Does it really represent the ideals that we exhibit as a society? You know, we've already settled the basic question that cruelty to animals is wrong. Most states in the 19th century passed anti-cruelty laws. And now it's a felony in 47 states to exhibit cruelty to animals. Dogfighting is now a felony in all 50 states. Cockfighting is outlawed in all 50 states. The difficulty, though, comes in application. How do we advance these principles in society when animal use is widespread? When we're consuming animals, we're wearing animals, we're using them for entertainment, we're buying products that may be tested on animals or not tested on animals. This is the great challenge that we face in our society, is how do we logically apply these anti-cruelty principles? And you know, I think we've had some wake-up moments in our country on these issues. You know, one wake-up moment in general about the connection that we have with animals was Katrina and the incredible pet rescue that went on in the harrowing weeks after the hurricane struck, and then a great American city was flooded. And this incident, I think, showed the charity and goodness of the American public. Obviously, so many people were deeply concerned about what was going on with the people. More than 1,000 people perished in the storm, and hundreds of thousands were displaced from their communities. Entire, you know, towns like Waveland, Mississippi, were kind of wiped from the map, at least temporarily. And our nation's attention was fixated on the plight of the people. But, of course, there was also animals all around in two-thirds of American households and two-thirds of those households. And after a couple of days, we began to hear about stories of the animals and stories of animals caught upstairs in someone's home or an animal clinging to the rooftop of a vehicle. And we saw animal rescuers pouring in to New Orleans and the surrounding areas to rescue these animals. And for those of us who were down there, and perhaps some of you went down to help, I was down there for several weeks, I expected to get the question from the media and others, you know, why are you so concerned about the animals when so many people are suffering? But that question never came once, because so many people realized that our fate was intertwined. And so many of the people, they lost their homes, they didn't know what was going on with their job. The thing they were most concerned about were their pets and their own animals. And I think that it put on display this idea that our lives are just caught up with other creatures. And all of the millions of dollars donated and more than 10,000 animals rescued from this terrible circumstance, just a quick reading on the opening of chapter 5 of the book, which is called For the Love of Pets. In a lifetime of being around animals, I'd seen some strange and interesting things, but here was something completely different. I was standing in the front galley of a Continental Airlines 727 that was soon to depart Baton Rouge Airport, surveying a plane packed with passengers, all of them dogs. It was like something from a Far Side cartoon, complete with chipper flight attendants serving dog biscuits and water. Given the desperate circumstances, everyone was quiet and well-behaved, and the sound of the captain's voice had ears up and heads tilted. Not one of the 140 dogs on board was barking or whining, not even the one stuck in the middle seats. There was something comical in the scene, but also deeply touching, seeing all these frightened faces wondering what was happening to them. Yet, however afraid they might have felt at the moment, every one of them was lucky to be leaving New Orleans in the days after Hurricane Katrina. These guys had already been through a lot. They'd been abandoned when the city was evacuated, left to fend for themselves as the waters rose, their food ran out, and they found themselves all alone in an empty house. When finally they heard a friendly voice, it wasn't their owner's, but one of the hundreds of rescuers who had come to help. Now they were bound for California, where others would take them until one day soon, if everything worked out, their owners would find them and take them back home. What mattered most right now was to get them to safety and worry about the reunions later. And you know, so many of the animals came to Colorado. The Dem Friends League took a lot of them, and other humane societies in the state took these animals. And the nation kind of came together, and we began to understand the depth of this bond, that these animals are not disposable, they're not throwaways, they're part of our lives and they're part of our families. And so many people stayed behind because they couldn't go to shelters that took pets. And they figured they were just going to take their chances and try to deal with the storm with their pets at their homes. And then, of course, when so many people came to rescue the Navy or the fire department to get these people out of a crisis circumstance, and the Navy or the fire department said, we can only take you but not your animals, so many people said, thank you very much. You know, I'm grateful that you're here, but I'm not going to abandon my best friend during his or her time of distress. And I think it was a wake-up moment. I think another wake-up moment happened just, you know, a year and a half later with Michael Vick's conviction for animal fighting. And obviously, dog fighting has been a horrible crime. We had been kind of raising the flag on this issue for a long time. And Vick's crime brought to light something that was going on in communities all over the country. What Vick did was horrible and barbaric, but it was fundamentally the same as what's going on with dog fighting operations all over the country. Not just fighting the animals, but killing poor performing dogs. And it kind of jolted the American conscience and reminded them that cruelty is happening in our own communities. And that people, even very successful people like top NFL players, could be involved in some of the most base activities. And after the Vic case came to light, we translated that into 30 new state laws against animal fighting, upgrading penalties, getting a federal felony statute against animal fighting. But again, I think it was a wake-up. And you know, another case was an undercover investigation that we did that we brought to light just a couple of years ago in Southern California. It was a slaughter plant that was slaughtering spent dairy cows. These were cows that were so battered and beleaguered from producing such enormous volumes of milk that many of them, after they're commercially spent, they couldn't even walk. And the industry has a term for it. They're called downers. They're literally down on the ground. And this plant felt that they could get any animal up and get them walking toward the kill box, to the slaughter area. So they rammed them with forklifts, and they dragged them with chains, and they put water hoses in their mouth. And they just caused them torment to try to get them moving. And our guy recorded this. There were USDA inspectors that didn't do much as this whole thing played out. And there were third-party auditors who came in and said this place was a top of the top drawer sort of slaughter plant operation. But our guy, with one camera, being there for 6 weeks, documented so much terrible cruelty. And I think it showed to the American public what the meat industry is capable of. That when we separate ourselves from animals, that we just treat, when we treat the animals as meat machines and just things and objects and commodities, we can do some pretty awful stuff to these creatures. And I really feel that the public is waking up on these issues. But when you're talking about confronting multi-billion-dollar industries that have a real investment in keeping things just the way they are, it's not going to be an easy fight. I mean, we're trying to reform agriculture and give the animals more space and prevent routine mutilations and see that they're transported humanely and even slaughtered humanely. And you've got 10,000 puppy mills in this country. At the same time that we have 3,500 brick-and-mortar animal shelters and we've got thousands of rescue groups working to find homes for animals without them, we've got these mills churning out 2 to 4 million puppies a year, kind of flooding the market with them, displacing the animals who would otherwise be in the adoption pipeline and causing a lot of suffering to the breeding females, especially at these mills. We've got, as I mentioned, captive hunts and animal fighting. We've got the seal hunt. You know, the seal hunt's been on my mind because it just started a couple of weeks ago in Canada. It's the largest marine mammal slaughter in the world. And this is, I've been up there and I take the reader to many places that I've been, and this area where the seals come to the terminus of their migration in southern Canada, off the eastern coast of the North American continent to these vast ice flows, 6 million seals come down from Greenland down to Quebec's coast and to Labrador, Newfoundland, and these mothers give birth to these seals on the ice flows. And it is an absolutely magical place. I mean, you see, it's cold, but there's bright sun, and it's refracting off of the ice. You get beautiful colors. You have sunglasses on, but it's still so bright that you have to squint just to prevent prevent the sun from kind of blinding you. And you can just see these mothers and these babies kind of as far as you can see. And the mothers are with the babies for 12 days. They produce a nutrient-dense, rich milk. And the mothers just kind of go off on their own. And they leave these babies who are essentially helpless. I mean, you can't think of a more helpless creature than these newborn babies because they can't swim for several weeks, and they can't run, and they're just left there without any maternal defense. And men come in boats with clubs and guns, and they come to kill these babies in this nursery of the North. I mean, it's just an attack on these creatures. And, you know, when I see it and when I've been up there just to watch the animals before the men come to kill them, I just think, you know, how many of us are interested in seeing these seals? I mean, of the 40 million Canadians and the 310 million Americans, I mean, for so many of us, this would be the chance of a lifetime to see this magical place and these animals in this ritual and one of the world's great migrations of animals. I mean, what if you monetize that? But how many people are really interested in killing seals? I mean, it's a declining number, just a few hundred people who perpetrate all this cruelty. And how many people are interested in buying seal skins? I mean, none of us in the United States, we forbid it. Nobody uses them in Canada. The European Union stopped it. The Canadian government is trying to find little markets in Asia and other places in the world that will buy these skins. And the value of them is now so low that last year, the gross revenue for this hunt, for the sale of the seal skins, was $1 million. It was $1 million the year before. The government of Canada spends millions defending it and promoting it. If the thing were allowed to rise or fall just on free market principles, it would be done tomorrow. And when I'm up there and I see this slaughter of animals, just like I imagine it must have been with the killing of the bison on our continent, where you take off the buffalo hides and leave the carcass to rot, which is what they do with the seals. I mean, I think this is the old economy at work. It's not economically successful. It's a myth to think that this sort of kind of extraction and killing and taking and bloodletting is a good, you know, is a good thing just in raw dollars and commerce. It's not. It's a failure. But what if we monetize the idea of watching these seals and being up there? I mean, the market potential of that. And that's the new humane economy that I'm talking about in the book, which is the last chapter of the book. Syncing up our values with our economic commerce and economic activity. You know, when you disassociate these two, your business enterprises and your values, you're left with things like slavery or child labor. I mean, that's not the society that we want. You know, we have a great country, and our country is founded on basic principles. Principles established in the 18th century in this country in our Constitution and the Bill of Rights and the Declaration of Independence. And the principles talk about justice and fairness and equality and democratic decision-making and free speech. Well, you can't have a nation founded on those political principles and then have something like slavery. I mean, we had to deal with that crisis. It took us 8 decades to deal with it, and we had to fight a terrible and bloody civil war in this country to end it. But you can't enslave a race of people or a class of people in our society. And you can't call yourself a democracy and then disenfranchise half the population. I mean, women couldn't vote until 1920 in this country. It took 150 years to get women's suffrage. But we had to deal with that question because these principles are meaningful and they're real about fairness and justice and decency. Well, we can't suspend our values when it comes to the care of animals. We can't treat them just as economic instrumentalities and just a bunch of objects and commodities that we can kill and exploit and do whatever we want with because it happens to be convenient. You know, the past necessities like fur coats are today's minor conveniences. I mean, little course corrections in our behavior, like buying a synthetic coat or buying a natural fiber coat that's just as warm, just as stylish as a fur. I mean, why would we choose the fur when we have an equally viable alternative? It's just not that hard in this day and age in 2011 to figure out a pathway where we can maintain our quality of life, have a robust economy, and not leave a trail of animal victims in the process. I mean, whether you're on the food issue, whether you're a vegetarian or a vegan, or you're an inveterate carnivore, we should be thinking about our food choices. I mean, I don't care where you are on that spectrum. It's wrong to immobilize these animals on the factory farms. I mean, there's no defense for that. We've got to be alert to what's going on in these settings, and we've got to take action. We can't leave it up to the government or can't leave it up to somebody else. We've got to be the ones to make some choices in our lives. Every time we go to the store to buy products, household products or cosmetics, I mean, we can choose products that are tested on animals or not tested on animals. These are simple choices for us because innovation and entrepreneurial activity has given us these options at this stage of the game. I mean, these might not have been options way back when, and that posed a really tough moral question. You know, do you kill these animals or cause harm in order to benefit yourself? But now it's not so much a benefit for us. It's just kind of stubborn refusal as a society to change. It's just the force of habit. I mean, we've got to break our habits when you've got this very significant moral question at work of billions of animals at risk because of human actions. And you know, I, in the preface, I tease some of these subjects. And just a couple of paragraphs from the preface. As harsh as nature is for animals, cruelty comes only from human hands. We are the creature of conscience, aware of the wrongs we do, and fully capable of making things right. Our best instincts will always tend in that direction, because a bond with animals is built into every one of us. That bond of kinship and fellow feeling has been with us through the entire arc of human experience. From our first barefoot steps on the planet, through the era of domestication of animals, and into the modern age. For all that sets humanity apart, animals remain our companions in creation, to borrow a phrase from Pope Benedict XVI, bound up with us in the story of life on earth. Every act of callousness toward an animal is a betrayal of that bond. In every act of kindness, we keep faith with the bond. And broadly speaking, the whole mission of the animal welfare cause is to repair the bond, for their sake and for our own. In our day, there are stresses and fractures of the human-animal bond, and some forces at work would sever it once and for all. They pull us in the wrong direction and away from the decent and honorable code that makes us care for creatures who are entirely at our mercy. Especially within the last 200 years, we've come to apply an industrial mindset to the use of animals, too often viewing them as if they were nothing but articles of commerce and the raw material of science, agriculture, and wildlife management. Here, as in other pursuits, human ingenuity has a way of outrunning human conscience. And some things we do only because we can, forgetting to ask whether we should. You know, I really believe in this concept of the humane economy. I really believe that it's the genius of the human mind, the intelligence that we have, that we can figure out a way to navigate this issue of living our lives without claiming so many other victims. And you know, I have a lot of characters in the book, and one character in the book is a guy named Chuck Anderson. And Chuck Anderson was out swimming in the Gulf of Mexico in the summer one day, enjoying himself. And suddenly, a bull shark came at him. And before he knew it, the shark had attacked him and severed four of his fingers on one of his hands. The shark made another run at him, and he was able to parry the blow. And then the shark came around a third time, and this time delivered a really serious blow to Chuck, and he severed Chuck's arm just below the elbow. With two severe wounds, he struggled to shore, and fortunately there were some people who knew what they were doing, and they slowed his blood loss, and emergency personnel showed up very quickly, got to the hospital, and they were able to save him, and he didn't die of blood loss. And you would think if there's anybody who had a reason to hate an animal, to have animus toward an animal, and certainly to have a vendetta against the animal, it would be someone who had a very personal, bitter experience, like, you know, having your arm bitten off or your fingers bitten off. And what's amazing about Chuck Anderson and several other victims of shark attacks is just a few years later, they went to Capitol Hill, and they were not there to lobby for, you know, removing sharks from the endangered species list or to call for their extirpation. This group of victims, all of whom had these terrible experiences, were advocating to an end to shark finning, where it's estimated 73 million sharks are killed globally in order to make shark fin soup, which is consumed in certain communities in this country and in China and some other nations in Asia. And to think of this guy who went through that experience and probably thinks about sharks every day and probably has difficulty doing little things in his life, to think of him being so other-centered and altruistic to advocate for these animals who are on the cuddly factor pretty low on the spectrum, to think of him doing that, I think, says so much about our humanity. You know, animals are a test of our basic character. And how we treat the most vulnerable among us says so much about who we are. Are we going to use our power for license? Are we going to just exploit because we can? Are we going to be merciful and decent? And I think, you know, for so many of us, we haven't had a, most of us have not had a bitter experience with an animal. Some of us may have, but most of us have just had our life enhanced and enriched by animals. They make our lives more whole and complete. They amuse us. They entertain us. They're a great force. Well, can't we give something back to them? And I think our time has come. I mean, I think our moment to see this cause propelled forward is here. But it's not going to be easy, as I said. I mean, when we pass a ballot initiative here and get 70% of the vote to stop spring bear hunting, some of the lawmakers want to restore spring bear hunting. And when we pass the ballot measure in Missouri to crack down on puppy mills, where there are 3,000 mills, lawmakers are trying to overturn it. So our path to progress is not going to be linear. We're going to have sideways steps. We even may take a step back every once in a while. But if you look at the arc of where we're going, more people are aware than ever. More people are conscious of their responsibilities. More people are alert to the suffering of animals than ever before. But it takes concerted action. Those suffragists and those abolitionists against slavery, they had a tough fight. I mean, I think we're going to have a fight. We're going to have to be organized. We're going to have to be involved politically. We're going to have to go to the Capitol for lobby day. And we're going to have to help elect lawmakers who really care about our issues. We're going to have to pressure corporations to make the right choices. We're going to have to examine our own conduct. You know, a lot of people get upset about Michael Vick, and believe me, I was enormously upset about Michael Vick, and we provided the legal framework under which he was prosecuted. And he should have been prosecuted, and he should have done that time. But all of us should be examining our behavior. And I know that here, just being here, all of you have reached, you know, a much greater level of engagement in self-examination than a lot of other people in our society. You want to be part of the solution. You want to do something about this. But this is a very real issue for every person in society because it's not something far off. We have moral problems all around us in our daily lives, but that means we have moral opportunities. And I think that, logic, our secular traditions, our religious traditions, all point us in the direction of being good to these other creatures. So I really hope you enjoy the bond. I hope you'll spread the word about it, and thank you very much for being here tonight.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you all very much. Very generous of you. You know, I appreciate every one of you. I really do. I appreciate knowing that there are other people who care. And I hope you take comfort in knowing that other people care about these issues. Questions? I'd like to take a few. Yes. Yes. Yes.
I'm probably not asking this correctly, but you first started out by saying you were excited to be here in Colorado. Does it rate pretty well as far as animals? I mean,
yeah.
You know what I'm trying to say?
Yes. This event is going to be podcast, so I'm going to try to repeat the questions, and then everyone can also hear it here and also on the podcast. The question is, how does Colorado rate in terms of animal protection? And we actually did, at the Humane Society of the United States, rate the states in terms of their animal welfare policies. We looked at 65 different policy ideas, and Colorado is actually in the top five. You're doing pretty well. But you still have a long way to go. Still have a long way to go. And, I think that this idea of being involved politically is so important. You know, lawmakers have, at the federal level, there are thousands of bills introduced. At the state level, there are a couple thousand as well. The only way that they're going to focus on the issues is if they hear a clamor, if they hear people really concerned, if they recognize that these are issues of such importance to the population, to you as constituents, that, you know, there's probably going to be some consequence if they don't vote the right way. You know, you hate to see that people aren't just doing things because it's the right policy decision. And, you know, many lawmakers do act that way because they think it's the right thing. But a lot of others respond to fear. And we have to organize. There are millions of people who care. and exert our collective impact to make a difference on these issues. I mean, the fact that this issue of spring bear hunting is even a question, 70% of the people in the state voted to end it. I mean, that should have settled the question once and for all. Mm-hmm. Question, yes.
Yeah. And it's a video that you really can't even watch. I mean, like 1 second, it's like, I can't see this. But I was reading about the other dairy farmers who saw and witnessed that video, and they were disgusted. I mean, it was just so horrendous. And they were saying, well, you know, this Mercy for Animals, they put out this video, and it just kind of distorts what the good dairy industry is doing, if there is such a thing. And so given that probably there's only 1 to 4% of the population that will be a vegetarian or vegan, and so if the animal rights groups or animal welfare groups were to spotlight those factory farms that were doing the right thing,
yes,
then there would be that competition to elevate all of it to a higher level.
Right. We're seeing the question is about this dairy farm that was the subject of an undercover investigation. There was some egregious cruelty, and many in the industry said, well, this is, you know, not normal, this is not standard, this is a rogue and bad operator. And the question is, you know, with a small number of people who are actually vegans and vegetarians, can't we try to, I think what you're asking is, can't we ask these producers and these industries to abide by certain standards. I'm just doing this for the podcast. To abide by certain standards in order to you know, really hold themselves to a higher threshold. And, you know, part of the problem is in the marketplace there are very few markers for people to make the right decision about animal products. You know, there are just a couple little certification programs, and the consumer really doesn't have much information. You do have information about cage-free eggs versus the conventional eggs, which are coming from hens and battery cages. But for most of the other products, there's not. Whole Foods has now started a new program. It's a 5-tiered animal welfare system. And the lowest tier says no cages and crates. The tier above that says no mutilations. The tier above that says the animals are principally pasture-based, and then higher and higher from there. So I think that for, you know, for those of you who are vegetarian and vegan, or those of you who are thinking about that, you know, I applaud you for thinking through that. There are a lot of people, though, who are not going to get there. And I think even corrections that we can make in our daily lives matter. Not having animals produced in a factory farm setting, or even reducing our consumption of meat. If people reduce their consumption by 10%, I remember what I said, there are 10 billion animals raised for food, we would save 1 billion animals. 1 billion animals just by reducing our consumption by 10%. I mean, that is an incredible number of creatures saved through a very modest change in our diet. So I think it's very important. And I think for the industries, they need to continue to step up on the animal welfare side. And I think the pressure that we've applied is causing them to. The undercover investigations, the ballot measures, these other problems. But they need to step it up at a higher plane. Yes?
Hi, what is your take on the pet industry, if you will? The reason I'm asking is because I'm actually part of the pet industry, and there is a lot of controversy about you guys. I really want to believe and support what you do, but we also hear, oh, they don't believe anybody should have pets, they don't want anybody having dogs, cats, don't.
Yeah, there's a lot of, you know, the question is, you know, what is our stance on pets? And there's a lot of talk and rhetoric about HSUS and I presume other animal advocacy groups that they want to stop people from having pets. You know, I've hardly heard a more, not you, that you're just repeating what you're hearing. I've hardly heard a more ridiculous thing in my life. We're an organization of pet owners. I mean, I've had pets my entire life. Just lost one of my two cats yesterday, as a matter of fact. But you know, we are an organization that is born from pet owners. The issue is, do we want to promote sterilization of dogs and cats to stop the overpopulation of animals and to stop the needless euthanasia of animals in shelters? Do we want to crack down on the puppy mills, which are conscripting these female dogs into, you know, a lifetime of breeding without any rest between their heat cycles, you know, keeping them in a cage? So, you know, we actually have a funded campaign against this by agribusiness. There is a campaign that is a multi-million dollar funded campaign to attack the brand of HSUS because we have been making progress on factory farming. So what their goal is to cast us as extreme, that we want to end all hunting, we want to end all meat eating, we want to end all pet ownership, when the reality is we celebrate pets and the place that they have in our lives, and we've been working to correct the worst abuses, like captive hunts, and we've been enlisting hunters to join with us to adhere to the basic standards of even things like fair chase and sportsmanship and utilization of the carcass. And what we've done with factory farming is to stop this intensive confinement of animals. Not to say that, you know, the animals can't be raised, but to say that if you're going to raise them, the very least you can do is treat them in this way. So I think that this is the struggle that any cause faces, is a caricaturing and exaggerating of what they truly stand for. And that's another reason why I wrote this book. And it's all captured in here. Our beliefs and our attitudes are captured in there. So listen, as you can tell from the questions, there's a lot of passion on these subjects and many, many different issues trapped within this broad subject of animal welfare. I wrote the book to try to capture thinking on a lot of these subjects, and I just want to thank all of you for being here tonight. And I look forward to signing the book.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.